Welcome to Conversations on Coast Access Radio. In this program, we have conversations with people about their interests, their lives, the things that motivate and excite them. So relax and enjoy this conversation. My studio guest today is Fred Driver, retired electrician, manufacturer, inventor, musician, all-round good guy. He's written a book called A Boy from Mihiwaka. Welcome, Fred.
Oh, thank you.
Tell me, where is Mihiwaka?
Most people would ask that question, although if you're from Dunedin, you would certainly know, because many moons ago, when the railway line from Dunedin to Port Chalmers was completed by around 1860, they couldn't progress the line any further north because of Mount Mihiwaka.
Right.
They couldn't go around it. What could they do? They could go through it. So they did. In the 1870s, it took about 7 years to build the Mihiwaka Tunnel.
Right.
And they did it with picks and shovels and blasting equipment.
Hard work. Tough men.
A big job, but that tunnel, which goes from, Deborah Bay, Port Chalmers, through to Mihiwaka, adjacent to Purikanui, is still in constant daily use. It's
right.
A mainline tunnel. It's a good one. Still right. There.
So how did your family end up in Mihiwaka? What's the point of arrival or departure, whichever the way you want to view it?
Oh, well, it all began in 1838 with the arrival of my great-grandfather, a sailor who had a few problems picking up water at a place called Murdering Beach.
Right,
on
the
Otago coast.
Yep.
Yes, yes. And I won't worry about the gruesome details, but he married a young Maori lady.
Mm-hmm.
At the tribe's insistence, and unfortunately she died a few years later, but they did have three daughters.
Right.
And in 1848, when a vessel called the John Wycliffe, that was the first shipload of Scottish settlers, arrived off the Otago coast, it was Richard Driver, my great-grandfather, who was appointed pilot to Otago Harbour.
Right.
By Sir George Grey in 1847. He was the man who went out in a longboat, boarded the John Wycliffe, and guided her safely into Port Chalmers. On his way in, he spied a very lovely young Scottish lady on deck, and a year or two later they were married, and that was the beginning of the Otago Driver family.
Right. So you pop into the world some years later?
Oh, I do. Richard was my great-grandfather.
Right, yes.
And to live at Mihiwaka was because, in later years, in gratitude for his successful pilotage of many years at Otago Harbour, Sir George Grey granted him a block of land at Purikanui, which is just down the road from Mihiwaka.
Right.
And, that's where my grandfather, Driver, Frederick Driver, my father, another Frederick Driver, they all lived at Purikanui before my father married my mother, and they moved to Hayward Point at the entrance to Otago Harbour,
right,
which is all part of the Mihiwaka farming district.
Right. So you're born there some 88 odd years ago?
I was, in Port Chalmers.
Mm. And you grew up in that community?
Yes, indeed I did. I attended Purikanui School.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful school. The role varied from, say, 6 to 12. Yeah, the school was frequently on the point of closure, but in later years, there was quite an influx of populace to Purikanui. It's a delightful area.
Right.
that they had to build a new school.
Right.
Won't dwell too much on that, but they built the new school. It was opened about a week and it burnt down.
Oh, no.
That's true. So they built another new school. Well, it burnt down too.
A bit suspicious here.
What makes you think that?
Exactly.
I just recently had the pleasure of attending the 175th anniversary of, 150th anniversary of Perikanui School. And I was I was one of three elder people present. I wasn't the oldest.
Right.
Might look it.
So that was your primary school?
Yes, it was.
Where did you go to high school?
King Edward Technical College in Dunedin.
Right.
That was a wonderful school. It took us through a more technical, perhaps, than otherwise secondary education. Mm-hmm. There was constant emphasis on maths, English, technical drawing, sciences, to fit youngsters out to be tradesmen.
Right.
And after you became an apprentice, we would go to night school at Dunedin Tech. I used to go three nights a week and Saturday mornings.
Right.
I was pretty keen on the trade. I was anxious to learn as much as I could.
You had a technical bent, as it were, right from a young boy.
Look, I was always keen on motor cars and ships. And, because where I lived, we overlooked Otago Harbour.
Indeed.
The ships were buzzing up and down all the time. Mm. I was just fascinated.
Because the coastal trade was much... what's the word I want? Much bigger back then, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. There was a big volume of shipping, but there was a big volume of overseas shipping as well.
Yes, as well. Yes, yes.
Yes, indeed. And the what really got me cracking on ships was when I was a small boy in 1938, I'd have been a bit over two, I watched a sailing ship leave Port Chalmers. Now, that would be the last full-rigged sailing vessel to enter and leave Port Chalmers. And she was there to step in a new mast.
Mm.
She was en route from Melbourne to, what's that seaport in southern England, where they discharge quite a lot of wheat for the... bread makers of England. She was heading down into the Southern Ocean, heading for Cape Horn and then up the Atlantic to England. Just south of Stewart Island, she broke a mast. And, well, a jury rig all the way to England couldn't be contemplated.
Mm-hmm.
So up she went to Port Chalmers, about the last place in New Zealand where there would be enough old salts capable of understanding how to do that job.
Oh, indeed.
Yeah,
indeed.
First they had to make a mast and then fit it.
Mm.
And they did just that, and a great job they did. And I've got photographs and paintings of that vessel, the Penang, which fascinated me, really got me going on shipping, and I'm still keen on ships, sailing ships, places of interest around the world. I went to Penang.
Yes.
Yes. Had to go there to satisfy myself.
Now, flicking through your book, didn't I pick up a reference that your wife also has a connection to the Penang?
Yes, indeed. that very day that I was watching the ship Penang sail from Otago Harbour, she was... safely at home in Port Chalmers, but her uncle, a fisherman, was out there photographing the Penang. He must have been a pretty good photographer with not a bad lens, I would say, because he produced some good pictures, including one that he gave to his sister, that's my wife's mother.
Mm-hmm.
It was nicely framed, and when I first met my wife, here was this picture of the Penang
Yes.
In the living room. And that didn't, certainly didn't deter me. I couldn't help but comment, what a great picture it is.
Where's the picture now? Is it still in the family?
Well, it certainly is, because in later years, my mother-in-law, with whom I got on very well indeed, presented it to me.
Nice.
Yes. And it has pride of place in our lounge.
Good.
In Waikanae.
Good. So, you trained as an electrician?
I did.
So where did that lead you to?
Well, this love of ships and shipping led me to the Otago Harbour Board, where I served my apprenticeship.
Right.
Working in the dry docks, on the wharves, all manner of lighting, cranes, motors.
Industrial stuff.
Oh, industrial electricianing, yes.
Mm.
Working with people with wonderful, wonderful crop of knowledge. You know. Looking back, I was very, very fortunate. I used to be loaned too to the Union Steamship Company, which had a huge marine repair workshop at Port Chalmers.
Mm.
And that was good. And, of course, my aim was to serve an apprenticeship ashore to qualify myself to go to sea as a marine electrician. And that's exactly what I did.
Mm-hmm.
I joined the Union Steamship Company seagoing staff.
Mm-hmm.
A most wonderful experience, very interesting job, a lot of responsibility, and a lot of satisfaction.
How many years at sea were you?
I was just on 3 years at sea, and then I spent quite a lot more time in the marine repair works.
Right. So how far around the world did you get to travel?
Didn't get all that far. We visited most parts of Australia.
Right, yes. Trans-Tasman.
Yeah. Oh, yes, including the wheat run. That was that was a biggie, because you would be 10 days at sea, maybe a day loading. You could actually see the ship settling in the water. Away you'd go again, 2 days to discharge. They kept us busy.
Yes, because we don't realise that almost all the world's cargo moved by boat. Modern aircraft transportation is still a few years away. So what are we talking, 1950s?
1950s, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and of course that was the age of, well, there was a lot more manual labour.
Indeed.
It was pre-container age.
Mm-hmm. So everything is either bagged or bulk. Yeah.
Yes, containers were coming.
Mm.
There was the roll-on, roll-off era.
Yes.
Came before containers, really. Mm. And but our ships, the ships that I sailed in, were either bulkers, bulk cargo, or conventional general cargo.
Right. Let's move on a little bit to talking about your manufacturing invention kind of part of your life. Tell us about some of the things you did there. Home Air. I think was the name of the company, was it?
Yes, well, it was Driver Electrical Limited was our company.
Mm-hmm.
And when we turned to solely manufacturing, we called it Drive-Air.
Drive-Air
Fans and Heating.
Yes.
Driver as in, you know, my surname, and
indeed.
Air as in air-moving equipment.
Mm.
I had this, some said it was a mad idea, that houses were changing quite drastically. In the 60s and 70s, metal-framed joinery was very much in vogue.
Mm.
There were hardly any houses not built with it. Well, that was good because, you know, eliminates drafts, etc. Everything remains fairly square. And next thing, houses were insulated, the roof was insulated, the ceiling was insulated, then the walls, then the floor. Pretty soon the house couldn't breathe. And anywhere, the first place you saw it was on glass, of course.
Yes.
Just streaming with water. Where did the water come from? It came from us.
Indeed.
We were breathing.
Yes.
Yeah, where people would not stop breathing.
Yeah, there's a good reason for that.
Yeah, I see, yeah. And so I claimed that ventilation was the answer.
Mm.
And I began experimenting with various flow rates, various materials and so on, and there was hardly anything available then. I mean, everything was in its infancy.
Yes.
What if you couldn't buy it, well, I made it.
Mm.
And till I had these things working, but the public wouldn't believe it. It didn't appear as if it would work, but certainly it did. You needed to change the air within a compartment at a certain rate.
Yes.
And all the troubles went away.
Mm-hmm.
People were healthy. The rooms were dry, bedding dry,
indeed.
Curtains dry, windows not flowing with water.
Oh, oh my God. I understand. Yeah. We had a brand new Beazley house built in Tamarindui in 1977.
Oh, yeah.
And it was one of the first fully insulated walls, ceiling, floor, aluminium joinery. And the water was like a torrent coming off the windows. We had to watch in the middle of winter when it was, you know, -3, -4. The water would freeze down the wallpaper. We had to tell the kids, don't pick off the icicles. So in trying to make our houses warmer, we actually made them much damper. Yeah.
Yes, it was a self-defeating project.
Mm.
Whereas the old houses were self-ventilating.
Indeed.
Tons of drafts and stuff,
mm.
but healthy. Healthier. Yeah. But so it was a bit of a struggle to get that one off the ground because the public didn't believe it.
Mm.
I was going to home shows, spent a fortune on advertising, publicity, still struggling along. It did start to go, yes, it did, but it never really took off until I had some competition. Now, competition is the great creator.
Mm-hmm.
And at last, here was another firm telling the same story as I was. And I think from that turning point, I became credible.
Yes.
People would think, maybe he has got something here.
Right, right.
And I can tell you that it was a long, hard struggle of, you know, a minus profit of such a thing, steadily going downhill financially, but determined that it was going to work. And we got to that point where it was working all right. And once we got into volume production, which is the key to all manufacturing, we were away.
Right.
We were buying materials at far better rates. And our products were a success. People were learning. People knew that. Mm. And it went on from there.
Yeah.
Until we had a factory in Paraparam employing up to 10 people assembling these things, all enjoying ourselves in nice, comfy, well-ventilated compartments.
Good. I'm just watching time. I want to switch you on to another fascinating topic. And that's music. I was at the event a couple of years ago where there were three of you playing trombone. I'm trying to think what the catch was. You're all in your 80s. Do you remember that event?
I do, yeah. Yes, I think the great thing about playing trombones is that it's wonderful for the breathing apparatus.
Right.
And it helped to keep one alive.
Mm.
The other thing, of course, is that we don't have to die. Old trombonists just slide away.
Exactly. So where does the love of brass band music come from? Is it something that comes out of family heritage or just something that you fell in love with?
Well, really, I started out on the piano, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
And progressed to the harmonica. Harmonica bands were in vogue.
Right,
when I was a teenager, harmonica bands they held sway. We had wonderful instruments, of course. There was the Hohner selection of chromatic harmonicas,
mm-hmm.
meaning you can play on any key you wish, chord harmonicas, bass harmonicas. we could make a pretty good sound, and we did. And the interesting thing is that I was in a band where my wife's brother was the conductor. In later years, I was in a brass band where my wife was the conductor.
Right. So you were really under the baton then, weren't
you? I certainly was. Yeah. And how I first got cracking on brass, really, was we'd been playing quite a lot of brass arrangements in the harmonica band, which, you know, I knew the workings of brass bands. And pretty much the day I arrived in Taupo on route to Wairakei Power Station, I was watching the local Taupo brass band playing away in the park. The music came to a stop and the conductor walked over to me and he said, you enjoying the music? Yeah, oh, I love it, yeah. Interested in joining the band? Well, okay. So I was at the next practice.
Excellent. And that would be the same brass band that my daughter Wendy would join many years later.
She did. I know she did.
Yes, indeed. It's a small world, isn't it, Fred?
I'll say.
So you've been associated with the Kapiti Brass Band for many years.
Yes, I was a founding member
in
1990. And we've still got some of the originals with us. And it's, you know, 30-odd years ago now. It's been a wonderful run. We've had some great times and some wonderful people. And indeed, this coming Sunday, we're having a function to honour one of our people who's been playing brass for 82 years.
Wow.
Yes, Merv Ellison.
Right, isn't that wonderful?
It is. It has started when he was 8.
Excellent.
And he's now 90.
Let's talk about your book.
Okay.
You've written this book, and it's a lovely, big, sizable book, A Boy from Mihiwaka. It covers your family history and your events right through from 18... Where was it? 1848, was it?
It does, yes.
Through the present day.
Well, 1838, when Richard first arrived, yes.
What was it like working on it? Was it hard to decide what to put in and what to leave out?
No, it wasn't. I first realised that I needed to do something over 40 years ago. And what really did it was the fact that I had I suppose you could call it a near-death experience. See, Edmund Hillary had always been, the man to admire.
Yes, indeed.
Yes. He first to climb Mount Everest. The next thing he was traversing Antarctica. Ferguson tractors, indeed.
Indeed.
How ridiculous is that?
Yes.
But you couldn't do anything better.
Indeed.
And he made it to the pole. And, jet boating down the Ganges.
Yes.
What a man. And of course, his work with the hill people, the mountain people, they loved him. He's a wonderful person to meet. A big, tall, happy, smiling, gentle giant, pretty much. It came to my notice in 1979 that Air New Zealand were going to do the odd flight to Antarctica and that Ed Hillary would be the compere on a specific date. So I made a booking and I did know the local, we lived in Taupo in those days, I should say. The local travel agent knew me and he knew that I made the booking on that date because Ed Hillary was the compere. A few days later, he came over to see me and he said, Fred, I know you made that booking because of Ed Hillary, but Ed has swapped places with Peter Mulgrew,
mm-hmm.
who will be doing a later trip. Would you like to change dates? Yes, I would. Well, that was good. And on the 14th of November, 1979, away we went to Antarctica. And an absolutely wonderful trip.
Mm.
I saw pretty well all the things I was looking for, except the cave on the Auckland Islands where the General Grant went in.
Right.
On a dark and stormy night. It was too cloudy, couldn't see it. But as we approached the Great White Continent, the daylight was so brilliant because Antarctica is a wonderful, enormous reflector of sunlight. Mm. And, of course, 24 hours sunshine down there at that time of the year.
Mm-hmm.
It was a most wonderful trip. Went around Erebus, had a look at McMurdo Sound several times. A delightful journey. Got back home, life resumed. A short time later, another flight went down, and there was concern by about 6 o'clock in the evening. The contact had been lost. Radio contact was lost. Could be, they said, you know, atmospherics. There was a bit of alarm. Well, as the evening progressed, that plane had run out of fuel. It couldn't still be in the air. Mm. And, well, we know the rest.
Erebus.
It ploughed into Mount Erebus.
Mm.
The world was shocked. New Zealand was torn apart.
Yes.
Oh, dear, dear, dear. I sat up all night listening for news. Indeed, my phone rang at 5 o'clock in the morning, and it was a friend. I said, "Good morning." And his voice said, "You have just told me what I wanted to know."
Yeah, because they thought you were on that flight still.
Yes. I hadn't seen him for a couple of weeks.
Mm.
And he knew I was going down to the ice. And he thought I was on it.
Mm.
Of course, I was booked on it.
Yes, indeed.
Yes. So indeed. Ed saved my life.
Yes.
And I've always been grateful. Now, from that point, I thought, you've got to get this down on paper, Fred. And I did. I've still got the fairly fat document.
Right.
And which I've used, of course, to write this book.
Mm. Fred, I'm going to have to finish us here, but that is a really prime spot to say to people, if you want to read the story, they need to get your book. How do they find it?
Okay. Well, of course, it's available in the local libraries.
Yes.
It's also for sale up at the bookshelf.
Yes.
In Waikanae.
Here in Waikanae. Excellent. And can I encourage you folk, pop in, grab a book, read it.
Yeah. Yeah, people tell me it's a great read.
Yes, indeed.
Lots of laughs. Gets a bit ridiculous because there's a couple of bits of that I dreamed up.
Right.
See if you can pick them.
Do you mean the teabag dryer?
Oh, no.
That happy note, I've been talking with Fred Driver. We've been talking about his life, his history, and the book he's written, A Boy from a Hiwaka, which you can get from your local library or from the bookshelf here in Waikanae. Thanks, Fred.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Conversations on Coast Access Radio, a program where we talk with people about their lives, their passions, their interests. I'm Graham Joyce.
This program was made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.org.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.